Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema for your free trial. Go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about the newest film by Tom Ford, Nocturnal Animals, we have Michael Slidell.
Hello. I'm trying in vain to figure out the connection here.
It's, take a look, it's in a book. God damn, okay. It's pretty simple.
All right.
Anyway, let's go on to our special guest for today. Bill Graham was too busy moving to be able to join us. So we have brought in a heavy hitter. It is Dan Mecca.
Hey, what's up, heavy hitter? I appreciate that.
Notorious. Fairly common guest.
Infant terrible when it comes to superhero films.
People have called you my nemesis.
Well, yeah, that's probably. I think it's accurate.
It's fairly I think it's accurate. I usually bring you on to be a dissenting voice on this.
happy to be here.
Mike, you don't get to get a comment like that because you're just always on.
Damn it, you're I'm not special anymore. On.
I know, it's terrible. Basic stuff. Follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Look for us on the Facebook. Search for The Film Stage Show. Give us an email, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And as always, we love it when you people give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. So do that, and we'll love you forever, despite what you say about us. I feel fairly confident in saying that. It's super early on a Sunday. I spent 30 minutes struggling with Skype, so I'm a little off my game. I think that's everything we have to do before we get into our review, aside from our wonderful, loving Mubi plug. Mubi is sponsoring today's episode, and as you know, Mubi is the streaming online cinema whose curators go out of their way to find the best of foreign art house cinema and bring it directly to your streaming device. Everyday Mubi. I was about to say interview. Everyday Mubi introduces a new film to their site, and you have 30 days to watch it. So you always have 30 wonderful choices to select from. I'm really struggling today, and I apologize. I don't know why. What is on Mubi? Well, we already talked about Jackie Chan. And we've been making a lot of fun of Lav Diaz lately, just because Bill has really started to dig into his whole two-hour time limit thing. So if you want to existentially terrify Bill, you can watch
yes.
Melancholia by Lav Diaz on Mubi. That is an eight-hour film.
Or suggest we watch it.
No. I have a child. I cannot devote what amounts to an entire days of work just to watching a Lav Diaz film. But yes, if you would like your free 30-day trial, you can go to mubi.com/filmstage and get a free 30-day trial so that you can understand the wonder that is Mubi. And at some point during that 30 days, you might have enough time to watch an entire Lav Diaz film. And that's just one of those things that you want to be able to say you did. But that all aside, I think, gentlemen, that we can now get into our feature review, which again is Nocturnal Animals, the newest film written and directed by Tom Ford. And this movie stars Isla Fisher as Amy Adams. It also stars Amy Adams.
Oh, no.
Jake Gyllenhaal. A weird, wonderful turn by Michael Shannon, as well as work by Aaron Taylor Johnson, Armie Hammer, Laura Linney, Andrea Riseborough, and Michael Sheen. Here is the trailer.
Do you ever feel like your life has turned into something you never intended? I'm worried about you. Were you sleeping? You scared me the last time we talked. You know me. I never sleep. My ex-husband used to call me a nocturnal animal.
I didn't know you had an ex-husband.
I've been thinking about him a lot lately. And then recently he sent me this book that he's written. It's violent and it's sad. And he dedicated it to me.
Okay, so that is the trailer for Nocturnal Animals. How best to describe this film? Amy Adams plays an art curator who is married to a businessman who is played by Armie Hammer. One day her ex-husband, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, sends her a manuscript that he has written and dedicated to her, and the movie is her present situation intercut with both recollections of their past and her mental creation of the book as she reads it. It is actually a lot easier to follow than it sounds when I lay it out like that. This is from Tom Ford, who previously directed A Single Man, starring Colin Firth. And that was a beautiful, lovely, heartfelt tone poem. This is something very different. So let's see what we thought of it. Let's start with
Dan Brian.
Nope, I'm not going first. Dan Mack.
Thank you. There's a lot to say about the movie, I guess, critically, in terms of just kind of the way it's put together and some choices that Tom Ford makes. Kind of off the top, you know, from the top, the nice thing about Tom Ford movies, at least the two that he's made so far, is that every actor's going to look the most beautiful they've looked in a movie, basically. They're going to wear the most beautiful clothes that you'll ever see them wear. Abel, you know, the composer whose last name I always mess up, Abel Korzenowski, or whatever it is, has been the composer for his two movies. He's going to give you an amazing score. The cinematography is everything's going to be like beautiful and amazing to look at. So no matter what, it's going to be kind of that enjoyment aesthetically. And then, you know, not unlike A Single Man, the other parts of it, it's kind of how much you care about that. Like, honestly, it's funny, but it's kind of how much you really want to care about all the other parts of the movie. I mean, I really enjoyed A Single Man. I really enjoyed Nocturnal Animals. I don't know how good it is, you know, but I don't know how much that matters. I think there's a lot of kind of silly moments. Michael Shannon is a standout, obviously. He plays a sheriff or detective, whatever, in West Texas, as part of the novel within the movie. And I love Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie, him playing kind of multiple roles, quote unquote. And Amy Adams is great, and she's got some really dark lipstick. And that's kind of where I'll leave it off. I really enjoyed it. I mean, there's a lot of things in it, like Aaron Taylor Johnson's performance, where. I mean, I think some people love it. I think there's another way to look at it. Like, why? But it's one of these movies where it's fun to talk about because it's weird, but also not nearly as weird as I think it would. Like you said, almost when you were describing it, Brian. Almost not nearly as weird as you would think it would be. Like if someone described the movie to me the way that you were just talking about it, like laying it out, I would think, oh, that sounds really labyrinthian and this and that. And really it's not. It's like really not like that. And so it's kind of interesting. But I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I really enjoyed it. So that's kind of where that's where I'll leave it for now.
Yeah. Like you said, there's it's not difficult to follow. The actors in it and the way each different style is shot definitely helps to distinguish everything visually so that you're never kind of questioning what the hell's going on and whether you're in the past or the present or the book. They don't pull any tricks like that. They want you to know exactly what is going on in Amy Adams's head. So I loved that. I liked this movie, even though I don't quite know what to make of it. It would be hard for me to mount a defense of this movie against anyone who did not like it, because there would be times when I just have to like shrug my shoulders and go, yeah, like, I don't get it either, man. But I was on its wavelength and I dug it. I think that saying Amy Adams is great in it and wears dark lipstick is like a perfect way to like level a critique of this film.
Like I spent so much of the time when she was on screen in the modern day, when her hair was the way her hair was like just so over her eye.
Yeah.
I spent so much of the movie watching that hair and being like, oh, it's really interesting the way her hair is just sitting there like that. I mean, and like, honestly, it's like so. And maybe because I know Tom Ford is making this movie, you know, and I know who he is and I know his background as, you know, as a fashion icon and all this mm-hmm. stuff, that probably lends to that, you know, where I'm like watching Armie Hammer and I'm like, yeah, wow, Armie Hammer is really handsome. You know what I mean? Like,
goddamn blazer.
Yeah. I'm just like, God, he looks good. Right. But
in A Single Man, I had the same problem where I was like, you know, you got to stop fucking making Colin Firth look so good, because I can't focus on anything.
Or any flashback in A Single Man where just in black and white, like fashion shots of Matthew Good. And you're just like, hello. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. But that's like the way he makes these movies. And, you know, and to your point about not being able to mount a defense, when I was in the theater seeing this movie, I saw it a few weeks ago, actually in New York, there's one particularly tough to watch 10-minute sequence where involving Isla Fisher on a road in West Texas. And it's hard to watch. It's like really, you know, it's well done, but it's like brutal.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that sequence, this woman in the theater just goes, why are we watching this? And I usually get mad when people, you know, like I'll get it frustrated when people talk around their phone or something. But in that moment I was like, yeah, no, I get it. I get the question.
You ask that same question like immediately upon this movie beginning, because the movie opens with one of the most assaultive, like just purposefully disconcerting montages that I've ever seen on film. And it then doesn't really play in any way into the themes or the ideas that the movie's putting across. At least I don't think so. And it really does seem to be there just to be like, just to weed you out, like to try to.
Well, yeah. And Tom Ford's spoken about that opening, because it's been a little controversial, because people were like, oh, is this insult? Like, basically, it's all these, you know, heavier women dancing naked to the camera. Right. That's right. And it's in slow motion and it's aggressive. Right. Would be a word to describe it. It's just a very aggressive way.
They're completely naked and they're not they're not like TV overweight.
They're overweight women and they're dancing. And I mean, and, you know, and it's just. More than anything, it's just shocking. You're like, okay, here we go. And it's like over this beautiful, you know, string score by the composer we were talking about earlier. And Tom Ford has said in interviews that like, he shot it to be like, you know, almost like the witches introducing a story type of a thing, like that type of thing. But then he felt bad that was his intention, because it like that makes the women, that would suggest the women are like an evil force, that he like fell in love with these women while filming, and you know, but he still has it in the movie, and you're like, okay, you know, it feels a little exploitative, but then, you know, he wants it to be more of a celebration, but the music kind of betrays that. And there's a lot of that stuff in this movie. Like there's a lot of, you know, I think Tom Ford wanted to make a movie that made fun of a lot of his rich friends in Los Angeles, but also has a lot of stuff in it that would make his rich friends happy. So it's weird because it's like there's scenes where you're like, oh yeah, this is funny. We're having like there's a scene with Michael Sheen and Andrea Riseborough and, you know, crazy wigs and stuff like that. And it's funny, and they're making it clearly Tom Ford's making fun of like LA culture. And then there are other scenes where like he's making fun of like, you know, bumfuck Texas, and you're like, well, this shouldn't be in the same movie, and yet here it is, and it exists. So
yeah, and so that's something that's probably going to have to be wrestled with, is just the fact that there's a lot of very cheeky, insulting stuff here, and it's hard to tell how much of that springs from the characters and how much of it springs from the director, which I guess we can get into later. But in general, I really dug this film and what it was doing. Again, sometimes just because I got a close-up of Amy Adams with her dramatic eyelashes and her dark lipstick and her hand poised just so next to her cheek with her diamond-encrusted engagement ring catching the light just so. I mean, Tom Ford can make a thing look beautiful, and I think that the oddity and the darkness of the story helps, but I don't know that it really coheres thematically at the end of it. But the ride was fun, and I kind of think I know what it was going for, and even if I didn't, the ride was fun, so I can still say that. So this probably won't be on my top 10. I'll probably buy it when it comes out, because every once in a while I'm gonna just want to watch this crazy thing again, but it's not quite as profound as A Single Man was, and I think that's going to throw some people. But yeah, I for me, I would say it's a hell of a ride, and a ride that I enjoyed taking. But Michael Snydell, what did you think of Nocturnal Animals?
That was some fun setup there, guys. I guess I am going to be that person that you described, because I don't know. I honestly wish I was more hypnotized by the things you were saying, because I'd honestly, those brief moments of insanity, things like Aaron Taylor Johnson, things like Michael Shannon, even the intro, I they were kind of oases for me, because I just found this movie so tremendously boring for long periods of time. And I guess what it is, is it's probably a little bit my personal taste, in the sense that I don't generally like when characters are pitched at such extremes. If the movie is then handled in a very like sterile way. And so the thing about this is that, you know, I think a lot of people have compared this to Nicholas Winding Refn's Neon Demon, which is another film I felt similar-ish things about this. This might have actually a little more to say than Neon Demon, honestly. But
Had like one thing to say, and it said it very loudly and clearly. And this thing has a lot to say, and I think that maybe it doesn't know which one to say when or how.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing about this is this sets up a lot of contrast, in the sense of, you know, you have characters who are the extreme spectrum of, you know, weak and strong, rich and poor, selfish and compassionate. And it wants to try to like mine things about class in there and sexism and masculinity. And I'd honestly like, it more just annoyed me or did nothing at all more than anything else. Like it just, I would have rather had it shock me more than anything, or I just, it just is in such this, it hangs in this weird limbo for me, in I just wanted the, I just wanted, it, I guess, exactly what Tom Ford is not. I have not seen A Single Man. I've heard a lot about it over the years. And I mean, as I understand it, maybe you guys can correct me, but this is a lot more visually reined in terms of at least how much it cuts. Is that fair?
I would say yes. A Single Man had sort of more montage, and it also did a lot more with color
and okay.
certain things in there. This was a little bit more conventional, it felt to me.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, I like this is, as you guys have mentioned, like an extraordinary spectacle. I mean, I think Seamus McGarvey, the DP, you know, I do like the refined slickness and like the artificiality of so many things. There's an early scene where they're in Texas where the horizon literally looks like a soundstage. And I think there's a lot of scenes in here where he is very clearly trying to, you know, partition or, you know, create a partition between, you know, the different stories and when we can figure out which is which. But I really like all the things this was trying to do. But from moment to moment, I just wanted it to be something more. And I guess we can get more into it specifically. But I guess from what I'm saying, there's one half of this story that I think works way, way better than the other one. And Michael Shannon is in that half.
Oh, my God. Michael Shannon. Let's just all moment of silence for Michael Shannon. Just out of pure respect, because that man, first of all, he shows up and I just started laughing. Like, because I was just so excited for Michael Shannon to be in this. And he's got the mustache and the hat.
I really wanted to see the movie that Michael Shannon and Aaron Taylor Johnson were in over this one. And I guess that's just my personal taste, because I like camp and I like things that are, you know, so exaggerated. And this is exaggerated, but it's also done in such a, you know, I obviously this is the type of movie that Amy Adams' character would have made, which I guess, you know, I need to say that's somewhat the point. Like,
yeah.
As you guys have talked about, this is
right,
very
exactly,
much
yeah.
a piece of provocation that is taunting you. That it's going, or excuse me, it's taunting you in its opening moments that, hey, this is trying to get a rise out of you. But I would have honestly rather be more offended by things, or more surprised, or just engaged in the struggle between understanding, or sorry, not engaged in the struggle, engaged in understanding why this film is so intent on mirroring so many things beyond the obvious points. I just, this is like, it just, it's a, I just feel like it's so keen to remind me over and over that this is meant to be an experience and I'm supposed to be inside and out of it. And by the end, I was neither. I was just checked out. So, I mean, I really would – I'm looking forward to talking about it more, but this really did almost nothing for me.
I find that hard to believe. Not saying that you're wrong, because obviously you would know if it did something for you, but just like just the pure amount of stuff happening on a visual and plot level, just like it was impossible for me to not be engaged by this movie just because there's just so much happening. And
I find it pretty easy to believe. I mean, as someone who did take a lot from it, you know, I like you were saying earlier, Ryan, you know, when you're saying, you know, mounting a defense would be a little bit difficult. I kind of, you know, Michael, hear what you're saying in the sense of it's an easy movie, not unlike you referenced Neon Demon, not unlike that movie in so much as it's doing something, and then early on, if you're not with it, right? If you're just kind of like, this is striking me cold. This is not really working for me the way that these characters are, you know, these actors are playing their roles, whatever. Then yeah, I mean that's going to be the next 2 hours. You know what I mean? And you're going to walk away from it, you know, 2 hours later being like, ah, God, that was a slog, right? Where you know, if you're intrigued by some things early on, you know, you're going to feel differently. I mean, we all have to agree that Laura Linney's cameo in this movie, though, is
and her wig or not wig.
That wig should get 4 Oscars. That wig is. When she showed up with that wig, I was like, sweet mother of God, this is the greatest movie ever.
Best hair and makeup, best special effects, best supporting actress.
Oh my gosh, she should just win everything. Just comes out of nowhere, just like a fireball. I could have used 40 more scenes with Laura Linney.
For sure. I would love that movie.
exactly.
I just, like, if you want to tell me the movie makes no sense, if you want to tell me that it's pitched too high, I get it. I guess, like, the one thing I can't imagine is just, like, not really feeling much of anything.
I think it makes complete sense. I don't really think it's, I mean, it's, like, silly, but it makes sense within the internal context and, you know.
All right, that's fine.
I'm sorry. What are you asking in the sense there?
I wasn't asking anything.
I feel like that's
saying, it just seems like there's so much happening that, like, to feel nothing or to not feel in any way provoked just is a little weird. But like you said, you did dig Laura Linney and Michael Shannon and Aaron Taylor Johnson. So there is that. So we've got that going for us. And yeah, I guess I don't even know how to approach this now. Do we just go into spoilers and start talking?
Go into spoilers. Let's do it.
All right. Well, I'm gonna say, see this movie, but don't come to me looking for answers. And I apologize in advance if it's not your thing. But I'm all in for this. Dan, it sounds like you too would say that people should go check this out.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would say go see it. I'm not going to tell my parents to go see it, you know.
Really? But no.
but it is the type of thing you'd want to be like, tell someone, you know, there's some hard things to watch. It's not insanely violent or anything like that, but it's, you know, there's an extended sequence that's hard to watch and that, but I liked it, and you know, I'd basically recommend it to all my friends, you know, to go see it. Yeah,
there's like a MPA rating thing that's not like violence, but it's like peril or
dramatic terror.
yeah.
And Michael Snydell, would you tell people that this is not worth their time?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think it depends on people's taste and what they're looking for. I mean, there's a lot of people I know who are just fascinated by things that are just like so aesthetically calculated and thought out. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely recommend that to them. Just cause I do want absolutely more reactions. It's just like, I guess I don't know. Dan, did you see L?
I have not seen L yet. No.
Okay. Well, I just feel like this movie has quite a bit in common with that one too. And I liked, I guess it's apples and oranges, but it's,
well,
these
no, Ver,
things
Paul
present
Pinoff,
similarly yeah. Aesthetic surfaces and unpeel the layers in more interesting ways here. And honestly, I actually would like to hear more about why you guys like Amy Adams so much in this, because I found her just kind of like, she's such a good presence she's just such a poised and internal presence that I see why people like her, but I'm a little bit confused by all of the awards conversation that's going on around her. So, you know, I just I guess I'd recommend this to some people. Is that fair?
I guess so.
All right, almost got into spoilers there. Let's do this.
Yeah, let's rock on into spoilers. So, spoilers for Nocturnal Animals. That scene, that like 10-minute scene on the road, is real tough to watch. And I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you is, did it did it strike people, like, when she says that his book is, like, dark and powerful and devastating, given what we see of it, which obviously is her mind's creation of it, does that sound real? Like, does that sound true to you?
Well, one of the things, and this is one of the things about this movie, which is a recurring thing in this movie, which, you know, might be one of the reasons, Michael, why you weren't really with it, is because, like, no, right? That book that he's writing, I feel like I could buy that book at an airport bookshop, mm-hmm. right? Like, right. That was what was funny to me. Like, I got no problem with, you know, John Grisham or, you know, any of these guys. Like, I that's a type of novel, and I read those novels, and I read other novels. But it's funny that, like, he's writing a book called Nocturnal Animals, and she's describing it like it's like Faulkner wrote it. and the movie we're watching that is the book is just like, it's like a Texas noir yarn. Right. Yeah, more than anything. Like, there's no, like, what's the struggle? I guess like his thing about he was a weak man, he becomes a strong man, and there's that in it. And then you go back to the flashbacks where, you know, young Jake Gyllenhaal. What's his character's name? I don't remember. I have no
record. Edward and Tony.
Edward in real life, and then Tony in the, right? And then,
yes.
No.
Tony in the book, Edward in real life.
Oh, Tony, yes. Tony in the book, Edward in real life. Because, you know, Edward is like, you know, in real life is... He's kind of a softy. He gets mm-hmm. mad at Amy Adams when she critiques his work, and, you know, that's obviously an influence on the book. And okay, so that's interesting. But it seems like the book is more, or the movie of the book is more concerned with the actual getting Aaron Taylor Johnson, which is like procedural.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Sure.
It did feel like more of a procedural, and I don't know if, you know, just because, like, maybe if we were reading the book, it would really delve into his psychology, or maybe she was just putting their past on it, because if you want to, you can really read into all of the things that happened between them in the real world and put it on top of this story that he's telling in his book.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just funny. Like, but like, there's a lot of things, like we were saying earlier, there's a lot of things in this movie that are like that, where it feels like there's a bunch of different movies that kind of are getting made. And like, maybe Tom Ford just really liked Michael Shannon's performance, and that's one of the reasons why it's more procedural. Like, I would bet that there's a world where Tom Ford wasn't getting something out of somebody else and was getting more, you know what I mean? And it was just like, nah, fuck it. We'll keep the scene, the diner, where they talk for 4 minutes about the case in, even though there's really no reason for it. You know, like, there's a lot of stuff like that in this movie, you know. But, you know, if you're with it, you're with it. And if you're not, then you should not watch it.
Well, Dan, I think what you're saying, I really do like that irony that, you know, she's supposed to be like, you know, the elite sophisticated, and, you know, she's just, as you're saying, acting like a Grisham novel is, you know, the next Faulkner or something. But I think what was more, what caused more of a remove for me is how little context we have other than her brief snippets of a relationship with Edward and a, you know, loveless marriage. And, you know, like, that stuff was so minimal. I've heard some people describe that it is about a 50-50 between Amy Adams' story and, you know, the procedural. And I just I would have liked more scenes, you know, like things where Jenna Malone says totally meaningless, you know, modern, postmodern, you know, blabber. Like, you know, that stuff would have at least given me some sense about her view towards her own art, or even more things that were trying to put that were trying to impart more doubt about what people think of Amy Adams, for instance, like gallery opening at the beginning. Like, that stuff is just kind of like brought up and then just left to stay. And so that secondary element of the novel also just feels so separate from me, because I have no sense of how these people actually interpret art in general, or whether they care about it previously. Like, I feel like her being only a gallery owner doesn't really tell me about her own view towards art. Like, I know she was an art history major, but
well,
that
seems
doesn't...
like she wanted to be an artist, but then got, like, talked out of it and decided to just be a gallery person.
As I understand from the original novel, there's a much bigger... Or sorry, the original novel that this is based on is that there's a much bigger emphasis on her as always being a reader as opposed to a writer. And like those are the kind of dichotomies I would have liked emphasized far more in order to care more about the relationship between the two. And so as a result, by like by the end when we're starting to flash back so rapidly and so... And so obviously at times, like I found myself being like, oh, brother, and rolling my eyes. Like, I don't know. I guess maybe that's sorry that went on longer than I wanted to. I just wanted to speak to briefly what you were saying there, Dan, about the high-level art thing.
Yeah, I think the answer kind of is that Tom Ford doesn't care that much about that. You know what I mean? Or maybe he just cares more about the story in the book, you know, and kind of the aesthetic that is available in West Texas as opposed to Los Angeles. You know, I mean, I think that there's something to that. I'm not saying it's I'm not saying it's excusable or right. Obviously, you know, I think there's plenty to be like I've said, I think there's plenty to be critical about in this movie, but it's a good point. You know, there isn't a lot of her in LA. I mean, I thought the same thing when I was watching it. You're kind of, you almost get the bullet points. You're like, okay, I get it. You know, she's in a loveless marriage. She's kind of not happy in her work, this and that. And it is, you don't get too much. And even, you know, the ending, you know, I kind of wish there was a final conversation between Jake Gyllenhaal and Amy Adams. You know, obviously, you know, just giving this, you know, we're in spoilers, but you know, the last scene, he stands her up basically, right? While she's waiting, sure. They're going to have a dinner and reconnect or whatever. And he stands her up. And obviously, I guess it feels like the right ending for the movie. But then once again, I don't know. I think the movie could end in any different number of ways. And I feel like it would have worked. I mean, there's a bunch of things happening here. And I would have kind of appreciated a final, you know, scene where, you know, you're seeing, you know, Edward in present day. And there's there's a conversation. But, you know, that restaurant she was sitting in was one of the most beautiful restaurants I've ever seen. So.
Those waiters dress better than I have dressed at most of the funerals I've gone to.
There's a wide shot. There's a wide shot at the end of them at the end in that scene at the end of the movie where the music like swells up and it's just a wide of her sitting down, and it is one of one of the most beautiful shots of the year. Like if you're putting together a, you know, 5 minute, you know, 2 minute, cinematography from 2016. That would be like
one period, perfect period shot.
Yeah. The opening or closing shot. I remember I was like, oof, God, it's beautiful. I mean, there's a lot of Seamus McGarvey. There's not many people better than Seamus McGarvey. And that is, an unbelievable shot. But that's the thing. I mean, those are the things that I remember about this movie. You know what I mean? I have trouble remembering the characters' names. You know what I mean? And that's what this movie is to me. But I really kind of loved it. So
yeah, me too. And it's the type of thing where it's almost like, oh, we could go into all the, you know, we find out that she began an affair with Armie Hammer and then ended up having an abortion and the child was Edward's. And, like, you could go into that and then how does that sync up with his wife and child being killed in the book that he's doing? But it's like, at the end of the day, it's almost, like, beyond the point. It's like those things are there, but they feel like they're there to haunt her, Amy Adams' character of Susan, more than to... like be profound things that we're supposed to read into. And it's really just this story about how this person's ex wrote a book and she can't help but like be drawn into it because she left him because she didn't like his writing and didn't think he had the drive in him to become a success, and now it appears that he has, and she's wondering, because he said, like, you sort of gave me what I needed to write this, what it means, and so she slowly starts to, like, unravel, and then she gets nothing. And I sort of loved that. I remember... Well,
the weird thing about that, though, Brian, is that, like, it's... I would agree with you that those things would just stay there if there was just a little bit less of so many, like, juicy ideas being thrown out in the script.
Like what, I think,
sorry, I'm looking at my notes, trying to remind myself. You put me on the spot here.
You don't come without something. You don't.
That's true. Nothing. Okay. Even the Laura Linney conversation. I mean, the conversation about how she's worried she's going to become her mother, and, you know, whether class influences these things. Like, it's just like, I feel like there's a lot of big ideas being thrown out over and over and then left to stay there very purposefully. But it annoys me because then I wasn't really enjoying that much the pulpy elements as a whole. So I can't really let all of those other things that are undeveloped just sit there, because they're a decent portion of the movie. Again, scenes like the Jenna Malone conversation, or how initially, especially initially what happens between Michael Shannon's character. Okay, and Bobby. When Bobby first meets Tony in the novel, like that whole interaction is so interesting, because he's like, why didn't you go when they called for you to come? Like there's just sorry, is that clear what part I'm talking about there?
I am aware of the part of the movie that you're talking about. I'm not sure exactly what you're
you're saying that it's scattershot, right? That there's peaks of interesting things throughout, but there's no follow through, right, on any of it, basically.
Yeah, no, Dan, that's a much more articulate way to put it. I think
you're this is the thing. Michael, I think you're right. You know, when Laura Linney says to Amy Adams, you know, everybody becomes their mothers, right? That's a great line. And, you know, you could have another scene where Amy Adams is, you know, wearing the wig, you know what I mean? Like a beautiful, a beautiful reveal where Amy Adams has that beautiful wig on.
He plays Christine, essentially.
Yeah, and she's just like, she's like, everybody becomes their mothers. And it's just, you know, but in all seriousness, I mean, I hear what you're saying totally. And I think it brings it back to, you know, how much are you going to let the incomplete nature of the movie be a part of your enjoyment or a part of your not enjoyment? I mean, I think it's a very, it obviously, like anything, it's very subjective in terms of how much, because, you know, yeah, the pulp part of it is the only part of the movie that's almost fully done, fully cooked. And it's weirdly the one part of the movie that, even though it's really done well and I enjoyed watching it, is derivative, you know, like I guess his book in the movie is derivative, kind of, and feels very familiar to, you know, any sort of simple Red Rock West, whatever,
yeah,
you know.
Speaking of how derivative that book is, one of my favorite things was that every time that, like, a scene would end, it would then, the movie version of the book that we're seeing would then open on, like, just random pictures of the sky. And I was just thinking of, like, every shitty airport novel I've ever read where, like, the next chapter starts with the sky was as red as blood, or, like, the clouds were dark over the planes. And I'm just like, yep. And even in the movie,
like, and I, you know, I don't, I didn't really, I kind of enjoyed this, maybe despite it, but, like, you know, Amy Adams is doing the thing where, where she falls asleep and the book wakes her up because it hits the ground, or, you know, she closes the book because it's too violent of a scene. And you're just like, are we still doing this in movies? It's such a weirdly, is it right? Did anyone have that reaction? It's such a weirdly, you know, retro way of cutting. Like, and I know there aren't a thousand movies made about people reading books that are, you know, whatever, but you know what I mean? Like, it was just such a funny, the way that Tom Ford did it, where, you know, her closing the book, you know, cuts. I just, it was very, I don't know. It's cheesy. It's cheesy. There's like a lot of cheesy. Yeah. Yeah, I do too. But there's a lot of cheesy things in this movie. And it's sometimes hard to justify that cheesiness with some of the more lofty lines and ideas that are like bandied about in other parts. So it is messy in that way, you know, because there definitely is a lot of cheese, and then there's a lot of like postulating on other things, and you know, it's messy. It's really messy.
I mean, I'm like the person who loves cheese. Like, I unabashedly love like showgirls and soap operas and things like that. And I think it's just every time I saw that, I'm like, no, go full into that. I would love that. Do it.
No, that's I hear you. I think that's a perfect way to read the movie. It's like, if you wanted more of that, you know, you're gonna be disappointed, as you know, for every time you're not gonna be disappointed. You know what I mean? Because it's like half half of that, half cheese.
I'm fine with like a bunch of like a. If you were to talk about this movie in terms of like a pulp film with a score, I'm fine with a bunch of ominous chords played on an organ without ever like getting to the part where they trail off and come to an end. Like, if every single scene in this movie had ended with a dun dun dun, I'd be fine with it. And I don't need the like final crescendo and ending. I was just happy with like all the weird, nutty stuff. This, like, even her recollections of the past had this bizarre sheen about them, and it just becomes so clear like what a dilettante this woman is and how she has allowed indecision and her own sense of self to like just detonate any chance she had at having a happy life. Like, she keeps saying, I can't do this or that because I'm a cynic, but it's like, if you're a real cynic, you don't need to tell people you're a cynic. People will fucking know, trust me. And I just loved it. It's this intangible, ethereal thing that kind of hangs over this movie like a veil. And I was just on board pretty much from the moment that the opening credits stopped. Because at first I was like, oh boy, what are we doing here?
Well,
that's really the best defense I can mount. Like, I can't say that all its themes were deeply investigated. I can't even say that some of those themes are meant to be there or investigated. I just, like, I feel like it's this very strange character study of a woman who's allowed herself to fall into a situation that she never really wanted, and the way that, like, this bolt out of the blue from her past kind of shakes her, and that's it. And it's a super simple idea that's given this level of complexity just because it's being brought about by this like Lee Child book that she's writing or reading. Which I'd read that book. It's a weird, interesting book.
I kept feeling like I was missing something. And you know, I guess this goes along with the rest of our conversation. I kept feeling like I was missing something with Jake Gyllenhaal's arc. And you know, once we learned that this was, you know, all a, you know, this is, art is vengeance, you know, this is him getting back at her for not having, you know, confidence in him and emasculating him. And, you know, like, but
well, is it just him?
I just
or
think
is
some
he
of
also
the weird
like upset
choices
at what she's done to herself.
What has she done to herself? Well, I feel like she was that same person even when they were in their flashback relationship. Like, she was still All right, maybe that's. I haven't seen enough of her to know that, honestly. But
I would say from the little that we've seen of her in the flashbacks and like the way she stuck up to her mother, and the way that she was when they first met in New York and their conversation about their past, like she used to be someone who felt things, and you know, even if it was just like her rebellious phase going through, like she was someone else. And he, when they're having that fight on the street, says, like, you know, you got to stop walking away from things. You have to stop shutting down. And she doesn't, obviously. So, like, obviously he's mad at her for what he did to her, or for what she did to him. But I think he also, at some level, wants to, like, twist the knife of this own, like, fake life that she ran away to because she thought it would be easier.
Yeah. No, I think it's all pretty straightforward. I just think it's just, I think that at some point, this is an easy movie to know if you like or don't like in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? Like,
you're not going to have to struggle with it.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I had to struggle with why I liked it, but I walked out fucking like, yeah, I'm on board for this. This is a good movie.
Yeah,
I don't even know if I can call it a good movie. It's just a movie that I thoroughly enjoyed, which is why, Michael, you texted me at like 2 a.m. last night and said like, oh no, we're going to disagree again because I saw your letterboxed rating. And I wanted to say like, oh, I wouldn't, like, don't expect me to go 999 on you because like, I really can't defend why I like this movie as much as I do.
Well, I think there is something really... I think you're all saying something. I mean, there's very few movies where I think it kind of transcends quality to be able to talk. I mean, I guess Neon Demon is another one I'm thinking about in relation to this.
Which I loved. Yeah.
Like, it's really hard. Even the most stout defenders of, you know, Neon Demon in this, like, they have a hard time saying it's objectively good in the sense of, like, I think one thing that is a little bit weirder about this one compared to Neon Demon is this does have a little bit, especially as we're talking about it now, I realize there is a reading of really digging into what's his name? Tony? No, Edward. Yeah. of Edward's novel as an airport novel. And then what this says about, like, people looking down at – like, there is just something a little bit uncomfortable to me about someone who's one of the fashion elites, like, creating an exercise about enjoying low art. Like, there is just – it feels a lot weirder to me than something – like Neon Demon. And I think that is what partly gets to me is that, of course, that I don't have that concrete tone to be able to unpack. Like, I have no idea how Tom Ford actually feels like this. I can read interviews and things like that. But as you're saying, it is like in many interviews, he talks a lot more about, you know, how much he wanted this to feel, you know, so... not expositional, exhibitional. There we go. I guess that's what the difference is between these two and why this one maybe bothered me more than something like this. Like, it's so strange that we have these directors these days who, you know, who are just known to provoke, like, you know, people like Lars von Trier and Gaspar Noé and, you know, Haneke less now, but Michael Haneke. And like, it just, I still don't know how I feel in general about films that their main method is trying to get a rise out of me. Like, that just so fundamentally goes against what I'm generally looking for in film, which is just like these invisible gears that are working together.
I'm all about like the clockwork storytelling and the beautiful moving piece of art that all comes together. But then at the same time, every once in a while, I love a good provocation. I was the biggest asshole in college. I used to invite people over to watch a movie and then put on funny games without telling them anything about it. And I would watch them instead of the movie. Like, I would just, like, wait for it. And they're like, I guess I won't spoil funny games, like, explicitly, but there's a point where people would stand
spoil
up and cheer.
Funny games?
There was a point when people would stand up and cheer, and then they would, like, cry. And then it was just, like, beautiful to me. Like, I love the fact that movies can get a reaction like that. And I love a movie like this that's just so bizarre without being like Lynchian levels of like out there weirdness. Like, there's something just a little off kilter about this that's just fun, that you can have fun with. And then it's not even that deep. You like probably won't have to think about it again, but it's fun to be a part of it for the time that it goes on. And that's where I'm gonna say that's my final word. Like, that's all I got for this.
I co-sign your final word.
All right.
And now we're going to talk about Amy Adams' eyebrows for 30 minutes.
No, her lipstick, my God. I actually couldn't pay attention to her eyebrows. I got caught up in the lashes and the lipstick, and then that hair in front of her eye.
Yes, that hair.
You can tell what time period it was in her life by where her hair was.
Indeed.
Well, okay, I guess this is a good point to mention this. I mean, do you guys think Amy Adams is I hate the awards conversation, but do you
I've only heard awards conversations about her in Arrival. I haven't heard anything about her or read anything about her in this movie.
What's weird is that I think she deserves it more for this movie.
No, I mean, she anchors Arrival. I mean,
she
does. You know.
But I think that I guess Arrival is a very, 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 very good performance. It might be, I mean, I haven't seen some movies that I'm sure will jockey for it, but it might be best actress material. But there's just something a lot more interesting about this one.
Yeah.
Her like tightly wound, like ready to break, and her like growing, mounting twitchiness is just like compelling to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I really enjoyed her in this. But, yeah, I mean, I think either one. But I think, you know, Michael, to your point, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe I've missed it. Maybe it's part of the conversation. But I've read that it's more for Arrival for Oscar. I mean, yeah, this doesn't feel like a movie, I guess, aside from, you know, score and cinematography. And maybe costume design, but even that's a little hard because I feel like costume design so often goes to period pieces and stuff like that.
Which sucks because Jenna Malone's fucking outfit deserves a costume design thing. Yeah. I would say Michael Shannon for best supporting actor.
I guess, yeah.
I feel I have a bias in the sense that I didn't like this movie, and I am in a conundrum where I have to pick a supporting actor.
Oh, so you're asking us to do your goddamn job for you.
obviously. And I do really like Michael Shannon in this, but it's not like I can defend his performance.
You don't have to defend his performance. It's beautiful.
But it's really weird that this is just like – this isn't the conversation for – maybe Amy Adams is more of a dark horse, but I've definitely heard Michael Shannon as one of the best supporting actors. Of the year, you know, Oscars or whatever. And I just like it. It feels so honestly, I'm kind of baffled that this has been received as well as it has, regardless of my own opinions. Like, this is almost a critical darling, which is very surprising.
I don't know what to tell you, man. I wish I could make sense of this for you. All I know is that, yeah, like, I just, like, that you'll never see a performance like this awarded at the Oscars because it's too weird. The movie's too weird. And it's too, like, fuck you to LA. And I just feel like people will take that the wrong way. And I think, like, they'll think it's easier to be like stand out in a movie like this, even though they gave the award to fucking Leonardo DiCaprio for mumbling and crawling for 2 hours. But like, because there's some weird thing where it's like, oh, this person is like a like Betty Davis nightmare, and that's fun, but it's not good acting, even though I imagine that it took a lot to get there. But Leonardo DiCaprio shivering after he's been submerged in like a fucking freezing river for 20 minutes. Oh, that's great acting. I don't know. Now I'm getting off on something completely different. I don't know what I'm rambling about anymore. I'm still recovering from my nervous breakdown from last week. So I don't know. But do we have any final thoughts on this movie outside of Michael hoping that we'll tell him what to do when he has to vote for awards?
No, I enjoyed it. I get the lack of enjoyment as well. And you know, like we said before, yeah. I got nothing but good things to say about that dark lipstick. So
it's like a good like fall plum colored lipstick. Love it. All right. Well, that's all for dark creatures. That's Dark Creatures, that was like the teeny bopper witch movie, wasn't it? No, that was Beautiful Creatures, never mind. Alright, that's all for Nocturnal Animals. Let's get the hell out of here. I'm losing my ability to converse.
Isn't there a whole scene in Neon Demon where they describe like different lipsticks and they all have there's like red rum, red, and
you're
like
either, what was you're either food or sex.
Yeah, that's right. God, how is that
I just
not
got
in
my
this movie?
Blu-ray Neon Demon in the mail the other day. I'm just going to put that on. We're doing like a lot of Christmas decorating today. I can think of no better movie to play in the background than Neon Demon. Anyway, so let's get out of here. Let me remind everyone that you can go to Mubi and get a free 30-day trial of their streaming cinema service. You can if you have a long flight this holiday season, like if you got to go from Florida to California and you've got like a weird stopover that's in Chicago for some reason, and you're like, man, I got like 8 hours on the road. What am I going to watch for 8 hours? Don't do what I'm doing right now and rewatch the entire series of House. Don't like put on the last 7 Transformers movies. Get your free trial to Mubi. Go to mubi.com/filmstage. Download onto your phone or your tablet Lav Diaz's film Melancholia and watch that throughout the entirety of your travel. You have that ability because Mubi does let you download things directly to your device so you can watch even when you are in airplane mode. So that's mubi.com/filmstage. Check it out. Other than that, let me remind everyone we can be found on Twitter at Filmstage Show on the Facebook. I just gotta end this. On the Facebook, search for the Filmstage Show. And that's about it. Give us a comment, give us a rating, and we look forward to hearing from you next week. So gentlemen, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found on the intervening time. Let's start with our guest, Dan Mecca.
You can follow me on Twitter at DJ Mecca is where I am.
All right. Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, criticizing the fashion elite. I'd love
to hear your criticisms of the fashion elite.
If anybody saw my fashion, they wouldn't. You know, they would take everything I say with a grain of salt. So,
jeans and t-shirts.
I love my hoodies. I'm doing a lot of teen stuff at the moment. I've written about best shows of the year and some other stuff. So you can check that out at Beast. And then the CFCA is voting soon. So, yeah. Things will happen. I make decisions.
With our help. You can find me on Twitter. I don't know. I don't have something funny to say. I'm always hilarious on Twitter. Follow me at Brian J. Rowan. We will all be working on the end of the year lists going on to the film stage, so make sure to keep an eye on the internet to see when those pop out. But yeah, that's all for now. We will be talking about something next week. We don't know what it is yet, but we will make sure to tweet it out so you all can be informed. But ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this week, and we look forward to hearing from you soon. Who wrote the book of life? Ooh.